This is the La Carre Cast.
Hello and welcome to La Carre Cast. My name is Jeff and I'm your host. Each episode, we take a closer look at all things La Carre. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Adam Sisman to the show. He is the author of numerous books, including biographies of Hugh Trevor Roper and A.J.P. Taylor, as well as his 2019 book, The Professor and the Parson. But of course, the most important for this show is that he also wrote John Le Carré, The Biography, which followed David Cornwell's youth with his con man father and runaway mother, his time in MI5 and MI6, and finally, his literary success. Adam's latest work is the newly released and, I would argue, essential follow-up to that biography, The Secret Life of John Le Carré. The Secret Life looks at a portion of Le Carré's life that was largely left out of the initial biography, Le Carré's numerous affairs. Adam, thank you for talking with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
There's something I want to kind of get out of the way right at the start, because I've seen a bit of grumbling from folks out there saying kind of some version of, why bring up all this dirty laundry? You know, who cares what he did in his private life? So right at the start, I wanted to give you a chance to talk to them and make your case. You know, why did you write this book and why do you think folks should read it?
Well, perhaps I should quote Le Carré's sons saying that they feel that however difficult, everything relevant to their father's writing should be known. And I think that, I mean, for me, I was and remain a huge admirer of Le Carré, particularly of his best work. I don't think all his books are as good as his best books, but then you would say that of any author. I think you should always judge an author by their best books. And I think his best books are very good indeed. And so I remain an admirer. I also, I know it's a strange thing perhaps, or slightly a personal thing for a biographer to say, I liked David, because we're going to have this problem, aren't we? His real name was David Cornwell, so let's just get that out of the way. I'm going to refer to him as David, but I, you know, those who know him from afar know him, obviously, as John Le Carré. I liked him, and we had a lot of laughs together. We had some difficult times, but I mean, to give you a kind of flavor of this, he once he said to me, I know it's supposed to be warts and all, but as far as I can see, it's going to be all warts and no all. And I think that was sort of, you know, that gives you a kind of idea of, there was a kind of struggle between us. There should be a kind of struggle between a biographer and his or her subject. But it wasn't all unpleasant. I mean, David said to me, look, I won't minimize the fact that he was very concerned about, and no doubt we'll go into this a bit more, in a bit more detail, about his infidelities being public knowledge in his lifetime. But he said, I don't mind what you write about me when I'm dead. And he said that his affairs were a kind of fuel to his writing. I should have the phrase directly in my head, but I mean, he very much accepted and took on board that notion. He said it was an essential ingredient, and that without the kind of jeopardy and excitement that they provided, he wouldn't have been the writer that he was.
I have my own theory maybe about why you wanted to put this. You know, I read your book, Boswell's Presumptuous Task, right?
Oh, really? Oh.
Which is all about, you know, James Boswell's writing of his biography of Johnson. And it upended the traditional way biographies were written at that time. And I could see, you know, having immersed yourself in the start of the modern biography, you know, where it is all about the fullness of a person, why you'd want to explore that part still with Le Carré after having done such a deep dive, right? I mean, is that accurate or am I off base?
No, you're absolutely, it's very shrewd of you to make that point. I thought that might be a bit abstruse for your listeners. But no, I mean, in Boswell's Presumptuous Task, I talk about the writing of the first great biography, The Life of Johnson. And I say how there the very processes of biography were dramatized, including the kind of shadow struggle that goes on between the biographer and his subject, because it is a strange and uneven relationship. In their lifetime, the subject is likely to be in the dominant position, but the biographer is likely to have the last word. There was no question that David Cornwell, that John Le Carré, was a much greater writer than I will ever be, and a record of achievement, at least four or five books that I think are first rate and will last. What's more, he was very successful, very famous, and very wealthy. And so he had, as it were, all the cards. And I had only really one card in my hand, which was that he had said at the start that he wanted it to be truthful. And this is a card I played again and again. I said, you know, if you want it to be truthful, it has to, we have to have something about your personal life, about what it is that drives you towards these chaotic relationships, which puts your whole family life at risk. I mean, it's all there in the novels. I mean, betrayal, as many people have observed, is the persistent theme of his books. Personal betrayal, as well as political betrayal, if you like, betrayal of one's partner, one's husband, one's wife, as well as betrayal of one's country and one's cause.
It's funny how the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? Because Boswell faced much of the same criticism as he was writing his biography, right?
True. Yeah. You have read it carefully. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, for me, writing that book, which came out more than 20 years ago, it was like a lesson in biography, because really every biographical issue is explored there in the writing and publication of that book. It's all there. So it was a wonderful kind of, what's the right word, testbed or something like that, to explore all those issues. As I say, I found them coming up again in my own practice as a biographer with David Cornwell. In a way, there is, well, I won't push this too far, but I mean, David Cornwell, like Dr. Johnson, was a household name, a figure of great authority, somebody who had attracted and deserved respect. And I did and do respect him. That doesn't mean I don't think he had flaws as a human being. And I think actually, really, those human flaws, as I indicated a little bit earlier, helped to make him the writer that he was. You can be a great novelist and have your life be a bit messy. And I wonder whether some of this reaction that you referred to isn't because perhaps I'm a little bit premature in this. I don't know. But I mean, none of us think that it's a bad thing to know that Dickens had his Invisible Woman. In fact, it enhances our understanding of Dickens. Or even that Johnson had his own dalliances with women that he wasn't married to, although Boswell didn't put those in his book and he headed them tacenda, meaning to keep silent. But then what could be published in 1791 is a bit different from what can be published now. I think now in the post-Freudian era, we expect to know something about the private life of those who we want to read about. And indeed, to try and understand something about the inner self that produces the outward product, the novel or the whatever it is, the poem, the play. I mean, it is interesting and I think relevant. David's breakthrough book, The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, was written when he was going through his first sort of adulterous relationship, where he fell in love with the wife of one of his colleagues, and a woman with whom I'm still, in fact, here in front of me is a letter from this woman, who still pretends that they didn't have, but I know perfectly well that they did. And it was the unhappiness, the misery of this that fed into The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, which is I'm sure that those of your listeners who've read it, which probably everyone will agree is an unhappy book. But that pain is important in making that such a powerful, such a bleak and powerful book.
Well, and I don't think it does anybody any favors to put somebody on a pedestal, which you kind of get the sense has happened. I mean, I'm just as guilty as that as anybody. I mean, I have a whole podcast about the guy's work. So, but I do think having the fullness of their character, and that is something that I think this book in particular got to. Reading about his life and his actions, this just made it so much more manic, you know, his personality a little bit. And I think that was something that was maybe not as obvious in your first biography.
No, well, I mean, it would have been, but he didn't want it to be. And one of the things we perhaps haven't mentioned so far is that my book is not just an account of his personal life and the complications of it, but also of the story behind the story, really, is the story of my writing the biography and our relations. In fact, one person who read the manuscript of this book, this new book, who knew David very well, in many ways he knew him better than me. I mean, certainly spent more time with him, said the most interesting relationship in your book is not really with any of the women. It's between David and you. It's between the biographer and his subject. I mean, of course, I'm very interested in that too. And I hope it's not just, it's not because I'm blowing my own trumpet at all, I don't think. It's just trying to kind of explore the difficulties of writing about a living person. I mean, it's very problematic. As soon as you, I just had someone here, a photographer, who was asking about writing the biography of Le Carré, and she said, well, where did you meet? And I said, well, I go to his house, or one of his houses, because he had several houses. And of course, as soon as you step through the door, you're their guest. They offer you a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, or a drink, a biscuit. You're accepting their hospitality, and immediately you are in a way compromised. It sets up a personal relationship between the two of you of hospitality and gratefulness or gratitude. And I think it's just foolish not to acknowledge that these things happen. I said in the introduction to my 2015 biography, it would be misleading not to acknowledge my feelings of loyalty, gratitude, and affection towards my subject. All of those feelings, even though they were tested at times, remain. And actually, it was much more difficult for him than it was for me. I mean, I was just doing a job. And although I had and have feelings, it's not my life that's being written about, it's his life. So I very much sympathize with him. I don't know if you've yet covered the film that's just coming out, The Pigeon Tunnel, or you've seen it yet.
Yeah, I have.
I found myself, I was in fact involved in that as a consultant, rather oddly. So I watched an early cut of it. I was really pleased to see David again, smiling, laughing, happy at times. I did think sometimes that he was, peddling some old tropes and coming out with old stories, which I knew were exaggerated, even if they had any truth in them at all, which is perhaps they didn't. But that didn't really matter. I mean, it's just nice to see him.
Well, and you talk about in the book how at times it felt like he wanted you to just write down his stories, to be almost a stenographer, right? Just take what he said as face value and put it out there. And I feel like with The Pigeon Tunnel, that's kind of what he ended up getting with that movie.
Well, I don't want to comment on that movie.
Yes, you don't need to.
But no doubt you saw the interview in the New York Times that Errol Morris did, yeah, where he was rather taken to task on that subject. I mean, I feel both ways about this, really. I sympathized with him, but I did also want to press him. And I did think that, in my final chapter, I talk about, does it matter if he lied to his wife? It mattered to her, obviously, and perhaps to the family, but maybe not to us. But in another way, I think that great novelists, and he aspired to be a great novelist, need to deal with truth, need to wrestle with truth, even if it's really painful. And perhaps he did shirk the truth. And I came to the slightly paradoxical conclusion that David Cornwall was a liar, which he admitted himself. In fact, he said on numerous occasions, but that John le Carré was a truth teller. So in his sort of fictional self, in the novels, he does explore those more fundamental truths. He does dig deep into his own psyche and bring out the difficult stuff.
You do talk about these various affairs that he had over time. And was there some sort of unifying thing that would draw him to these very different women that you saw or found?
Not really, no. I mean, they're a disparate. One thing is that, by and large, I would say they were all pretty impressive people, some more than others, but independent-minded, intelligent, that sort of thing. They weren't bimbos. They were people that would be enjoyable to spend an evening talking with, and as well as anything else, and quite remarkable in their own way, often having their own careers, and rather high-flying careers. But otherwise, no, there's no kind of unifying appearance. I mean, one of the most extraordinary relationships is with Susan Anderson. I mean, that is so extraordinary. He got a fan letter from a woman in Los Angeles who was in her early 40s, unhappy in her marriage. She was a museum curator, as he later discovered. And they started writing to each other. And the letters quite quickly became flirtatious and even intimate. And he didn't even know until she tactfully sent him a photograph that she was a woman of color. And they went on writing to each other these increasingly intimate letters for over a year before they met. They only actually ever met once. And yet they had an epistolary affair, which lasted 2 years. And an affair which at times they talked about making a life together. He certainly said to her that he offered up the prospect that he might leave his wife and run away with her. This is a woman that he only met on one occasion. Really amazing, really amazing. I mean, the letters are fascinating. And Susan, who I've talked to quite a lot on Zoom, I've never met her face to face, is an interesting, clever, thoughtful person who was pretty angry with David, I think, when the affair ended, because he backed off very rapidly, and it turned out that many of the things that he'd offered, it turned out not to, you know, they didn't happen. It seemed to me that she had successfully got him out of her system, which, well, good for her. But, you know, she had a clear-eyed view of him. I thought that, in a way, that was one of the most interesting relationships, as interesting as a much more conventional relationship we have with his self-styled mistress, who in fact turned up at his door one day wearing nothing but a Macintosh and lacy underwear. She was the kind of classic idea of the young mistress. I suppose one common theme is that they are mostly younger than him, quite a lot younger. And in the case of his last serious relationship that I know about, almost 50 years younger, but that's an exception.
So one of the reoccurring themes with these, though, does seem to be this common thing. I'm going to leave my wife for you, right? Like this escape. Do you think that was it something like he was just constricted with his life and like this was an escape from what was going on in his life? Or I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. Or if it was just the common, you know, like I'm going to leave my wife for you thing that might happen in an affair.
I know it's a cop-out, but I remain completely unsure whether, I say, was he a heartless philanderer or a restless romantic? I posed this question in my final chapter. And the answer is, I think he was both, curiously, at the same time. The pattern of the relationships was really that he would make all the running at the beginning, and he'd love bomb these women. You're marvelous, you're beautiful, you've got me writing again, I'm happy in a way that I haven't been for many years, all this sort of stuff. And I'm going to leave my wife and run away with you, or we're going to write books together, that sort of thing. And then when and if, as they usually did, they would eventually say, all right, yes, okay, let's run away together. You start backing off pretty fast, and soon a break off contact. It was as if he needed to seduce rather than enjoy. I mean, so you could say that the relations were not really about necessarily about sex, although you might get a different impression from reading the mistress who's written her own memoir, Zuleika Dawson, or Zuleika. I think they were more about needing to possess, to seduce, to make them love him. And maybe this is a bit of cod psychology, I don't know, but those who know about David know that his mother left the family home when he was only a little boy, and he had a motherless childhood and a heartbreaking thing, really. He would go up to any woman who came to the house and ask her shyly, are you my mother? He just didn't know his mother. And he was left with the feeling that women would always leave you, would always betray you. And there is a line in the autobiographical novel, A Perfect Spy, women were the enemy. Although he finds women very attractive, I think that he, you know, what he wanted to do was to win women over, like he wished he kept his mother there, and then leave them before they could leave you.
Yeah, it seems like that definitely was like a crutch that kind of he used to justify his behavior, right? I mean, that his mother leaving was such a formative moment for him that it repeatedly comes up, and I wonder, is that how much, like, was that a story that he told versus the defining moment of his life? You know, does that make sense?
I think it was a huge thing for both David and his had a brother who was 2 years older than him, who lived most of his life in the US and died a few years ago in Seattle, who I was lucky enough to meet and spend some time with, Tony. And I think for both boys, when they were sent away to boarding school, they used to save up their pocket money so that one day they could save up enough to go and find their mother. You know, they were like the lost boys in Peter Pan. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. There's a moment that I described in my biography when these two boys are cycling along a path on the way to school, and David falls off and grazes his knee, and Tony gets off and hugs him says, "Don't worry, I will be your mother." It's just a heartbreaking moment, I think. So David is, I think David was left with a really, really very ambiguous feelings about women. And when he finally did meet his mother as an adult, he didn't like, well, first of all, he's terribly disappointed to find that she wasn't the young, beautiful creature that he'd imagined. She was a middle-aged woman, or a lolloping old biddy, as he described her. So, you know, he'd imagined her as she had been when he'd been 5 years old, unchanged, but she had changed. One interesting thing that I found when I was writing that book is that when she was very old and in a nursing home, he did pay for her care, and he wrote her letters, some of which I've seen, which seem very sentimental, very untypical of the kind of letters he wrote. And I asked her, she had a daughter by her second marriage, to explain these letters, and she said, they're all entirely fake. There's no real emotion in there whatsoever. They're just written for the benefit of the care home staff. He hated her. And I think he went on hating her. Hating is perhaps the wrong word, but loving, but also furious with her all his life. One of the things I learned quite early on with David, which was confusing, was when you met him, he was the most relaxed, charming company, or could be, very seductive. I mean, he seduced men, not physically, but he wanted to make you love and admire him, as well as women, everyone. And he appeared a man at ease with himself. That's what would your initial impression would be. But I rapidly discovered that underneath that surface was a churning mass of unhappiness and unresolved feeling, which I don't think you have to be a psychoanalyst to put it down to his very disturbed childhood, because not only was he abandoned by his mother, he was then had this monster of a father who, as well as everything else, groped his children, sexually abused them, including David. So yeah, what about that for a childhood?
Yeah, wow.
David liked to quote, actually, what he thought was a dictum of Graham Greene's, that an unhappy childhood is part of the asset balance of a writer, although no one's ever been able to find that quote. But it is, I think if he'd had a normal, happy childhood, we might not have referred to John le Carré.
One of the other things you talk about in the book is that le Carré referring to these women as his muses, you know, and pulling things from them for his books. And so I was hoping maybe you'd talk a little bit about that. Did the affairs lead to the women in his books, or did the books lead to the affairs? You know, what? And I'm sure he'd have maybe different things to say from you. So,
yes, I mean, I think it wasn't one leading to the other, but a constant feedback.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is worth thinking about is the way in which he wrote. I think he, more than most novelists, perhaps more than any novelist I know about, he acted out scenes from his novels, sort of rehearsed them. I mean, for example, I learned quite early on that he'd go for walks, particularly in Cornwall. He read a lot of his books down in Cornwall, where he had a house right on the coastal footpath overlooking the ocean. Locals knew when they encountered him walking on the footpath not to speak to him, because he'd be in the zone. And they'd often hear him muttering in an accent of one kind or another, maybe an upper class English accent, or maybe a German accent, maybe a Russian accent, an American accent, who knows. He would play out these scenes, and he would roll the dialogue around in his head and verbalize it until he got it as he thought it should be. And then he would pull out a notebook and scribble it down, and he'd take these notebooks back and get them typed out by his long-suffering wife, Jane, and then he would cut up these bits and stick them on bits of paper. So maybe what I'm getting at is maybe there's an element of that in the muses. That it's certainly true that Susan Anderson, for example, and she's not the only one, recognized things that she had said in the mouths of characters in his novels, actual words. Zuleika Dawson did as well. And I think that they are sort of inspiring, but they're kind of also rehearsing. I mean, there's a very strange period when he goes on a sort of illicit secret holiday with Zuleika to a Greek island. And he's writing A Perfect Spy, in which the character who is sort of based on autobiographical character based Magnus Pym goes, that's the very same Greek island, the very same village. They're staying in the same village in the Greek island. albeit with his wife, whom he's deceiving, rather than with his mistress. And he does statements like, go for a walk carrying yesterday's newspaper under his arm. And this is, in fact, a message to his Czech controller that he wants to arrange a crash meeting, or at least it is for Magnus Pym. But David does this, and he got to be yesterday's newspaper. He acts it out. And what's particularly curious about all of that is, as well, or no, but curious isn't the right word, but some slightly mind-bending, is that when he comes back from that holiday, having written out mostly in longhand these scenes with his fictional character on this Greek island deceiving his wife, he gets his wife to type it out.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
I mean, it's all of these things really put some of his novels in a different life. Like, I'm thinking of Our Game, which is already kind of a fever dream with his lead character obsessed with his former lover, right? I mean, and it's hard not to wonder what was going on there to lead to that novel, right? And so, I mean, it does make you understand the process a little more than that I appreciate, you know? I mean, you get a little bit more of that, right?
Absolutely. No, and I'm sure I don't know the half of it. And I know this sounds too good to be true or too bad to be true, but two more mistresses have contacted me or emerged since I finished writing this book. So, you know, as I say, the book is just a sort of suggestion of how, or a picture of how he was in his secret life, rather than a complete account. I don't think we'll ever have a complete account, because some of these women are dead and some weren't at all, like the one whose ledger I held up earlier. And nevertheless, I think we got the general pattern, and I'm sure that's true of the Our Game character. I'm trying to remember when Our Game was. That was the one after The Night Manager, wasn't it?
I believe so.
So it would have been written in about the mid-1990s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can think of, I can think who might have inspired that. But
it's interesting, because then you also have this, like, kind of, like, lacking, with a few exceptions, to make his female characters feel like full characters in the way that he did with some of his male characters. And, like, again, does it go back to his childhood? I know that's what he would say. But what was the blind spot there, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, the common picture is that they're sort of idealized, impossible love objects, isn't it? And perhaps that's what he sort of set himself up to do, is to, he'd pick on these women who he would then decide were impossible for him to have. Even if they said, you can have me. But he would say, no, it's impossible. I can't possibly leave Jane. You know, so it isn't real. And in a way, I think for them, they were being used, really. They're not real people. It's interesting that the women that stand out in his novels are often hideous in some way, or very unhappy, or think of Connie Sachs, for example, who is, I think, based on a real character in MI5. I think, opinions vary about Liz, the character in The Spy Who Came From the Cold. I mean, she is an innocent and a naive, in some ways, I think that's quite a truthful depiction of what it was like for a young person who was idealistic communist in the early 60s, because anyone more sort of worldly wise would have realized that communism, at least East German communism, was not to be admired. So I think in some ways she is a truthful character. One of the things actually I quite like about David is that the two victims in that book, one of the things that makes it so painful is the two victims in that book, Liz and Fiedler, are both Jewish, and they are both victims of a highly placed British agent who happens to be an ex-Nazi. That's what one of the things that makes the whole thing so ghastly. David was not uncritical of Israel, the state of Israel. He called it at one stage a nasty little Spartan state, but he was sympathetic to Israel's predicament and to Jews in general, and many of his most sympathetic characters are Jewish. Mendel, for example, the retired police detective who crops up in several of the books.
Can we just acknowledge the amount of money that he must have spent on these affairs? I mean, it was just like extraordinary reading some of that.
Yes, he turns up carrying caviar and all sorts of treat, champagne, the fine champagnes. He takes them for five-star hotels. He buys them diamonds and flies them here, there, and everywhere. He did spend a lot of money on them. But I mean, another redeeming feature of Davies was he was very generous. He was generous with me. He was generous to charity as well. He gave quite a lot of money quietly to charity. But I mean, when we were together, well, for example, I remember him buying me the most expensive steak I've ever had in my life in an Argentinian restaurant. I would usually make a pathetic sort of attempt to pay half the bill when we went out to lunch. And sometimes I succeeded, or sometimes I paid the whole bill, but I would say 4 times out of 5 he paid. You know, we would eat well. And another feature of his character was that he had a very strong head for drink. I never saw him drunk, though I did consume quite a lot of drink with him. And indeed, I sometimes at the end of the day would go away slightly lightheaded, let's say. He'd say, about 4 o'clock, he'd say, "Shall we have a little drink? Shall we have an Armagnac or a Calvados?" And I'd say, "Well, why not?" And then we'd another and another, and then I would trot off happily. He was very generous, and he was generous. He did spend a lot of money on, which actually became a bit of a problem at one towards the end, because his wife managed his accounts, especially after the death of his long-term Swiss agent, Rainer Heumann. And she noticed large sums being spent on this and that and questioned them.
How difficult was this now two-book process? You know, I'm specifically thinking about how you initially came to it as a fan of his writing. Did that make the work harder?
No, I think it made it much easier because I didn't need to be converted. And also, I think that, you know, and let's be frank about it. You mentioned earlier that he sometimes seemed to think I should just take down what he said uncritically, like a stenographer. I think he had a completely paradoxical idea of what a biography would be. He realized that there should be an authoritative biography, and that if that was seen to be a serious book, that would help enhance his status as a serious writer. So he saw that as part of the legacy plan, if you like. But at the same time, as recognizing that, he, of course, wanted to say nice things about him. And I think he held these two contradictory ideas in his head, that it should be uncritical and it, at the same time, should be authoritative. You can't have both, as I said to him numerous occasions. I usually felt with him, by the way, that he was cleverer than me, quicker than me, more talented than me, funnier than me, older than me. But nevertheless, I felt I couldn't succumb. I had to keep fighting, because otherwise there wouldn't be a book.
Yeah.
There's no point in a book that just relayed what was said unfiltered.
You've talked a little bit about it, but like, it's just like kind of mind-boggling, because he had to know you were going to turn up some skeletons, but then he's like so distressed about your book that he's threatening suicide. It was like, how is he so completely shocked by when you do come with some of this information to him?
Well, that's very odd, isn't it? And it's not as if I went looking for the dirt. I mean,
yeah.
Anyone who knew anything about him had heard, and he said, indeed, he alluded to this in his initial letter to me, that he had a messy personal life. But I wasn't particularly, you know, it was only later that I realized that that was important. I just came across these women everywhere. I mean, for example, I went out to lunch one day with some friends in the country, and there were some other guests there, and they said, "Oh, we know a woman who had an affair with John le Carré. We'll put you in touch with her." Or late one night at a party here where I live in Bristol, I met someone, shows how pretentious the conversation was. We were discussing translations of Proust. I mean, I hastened to out of my depth. Anyway, this guy, who I'd never met before, said, "Oh, a friend of mine's mother had an affair with John le Carré, and she's got letters and inscribed books and things." And so on and so on. I kept coming across them all over the place. Well, I mentioned that two more mistresses had emerged since I finished the book. I went to a 60th birthday party, again here in Bristol, I don't know, about 2 months ago, and found myself talking to an old friend of the host, who'd been at school with her, and she said, "Oh, yes, we've got a family friend whose life was ruined by John le Carré. She had a long affair with him." He tended to give out to people that these affairs were short-lived. Well, that just isn't true. Some of them were short-lived, some of them were one-night stands, but most of them were quite long-standing. And most of them followed the pattern that we talked about earlier.
There was a lot of talk at the time of Le Carre trying to kind of kneecap you by announcing his own memoir right before your biography released. You've been very kind in your responses. Like when I've heard you talk about that in the past, you know, it's his life, his stories, he should be able to tell them, that kind of a thing. But I'm more curious about what was your reaction at the moment. Like, you know, you hear that that's coming out with all those caveats that he can do whatever he wants. Were you rolling your eyes? Did your stomach drop? Like when you hear this news, I'm just curious the personal for you.
No, well, by then, quite honestly, I mean, I was so weary of this. I'd several times thought, I'm never not going to be able to publish this book. I mean, especially when he talked about suicide, I thought, I'm way out of my depth here, you know. The last thing I want to do is to be responsible for the death of a man I admire hugely. So I was just happy that my book was being printed. And I think in a way it mattered more to him than it did to me. I noticed that Errol Morris gave me an interview the other day, said that David was furious about my book. I'm not really sure if that's true, but I'd known that he was talking about writing or producing a book of collected pieces, which is what the Pigeon Tunnel was, really. I mean, the main damage it did to me was not in so much in the English language, but in foreign languages. I think quite a lot of foreign publishers took the view, why have the dog when you have his master, as it were? We don't want Sisman, we want the real thing. And they didn't appreciate that the two would be completely different. And why should they? Because they didn't have them both for comparison. So the book was not, as I expected, bought by publishers in Germany or France or Italy or Spain. It was translated into some different editions, but not in those. And that was a bit of a blow. But as I say, you know, it's his life and he lent me his stories for a bit. I mean, that brings up another point. You know, he tended to regard my access to him as the most important thing. And he told me all these stories. And it certainly was very useful to be able to meet him and talk. But I increasingly found I was being told stories I knew already, or that in one or two cases, and increasingly I suspected in others, I knew not to be true. So for me, what was much more valuable was access to his archives and to people who would produce letters from him written many years before. It wasn't just a question of his master's voice. In fact, it really wasn't a question of that at all.
You're quite kind in the book, but you talked about his memo to you right as you're coming across the finish line. What were you really feeling as Le Carre is quite literally blowing up your book with the finish line in sight?
Honestly, I was...
Were you just like done? You're just done with it?
Relieved to have it done. I mean, you know, for me, obviously, there's a certain amount of emotional investment. I'd spent several years of my life writing this book, but it wasn't my life. And to some extent, it was a professional job. I mean, I wanted him to think well of the book. Of course I did. And I think in a way, his reaction showed that I'd hit the nerve or hit the spot in many ways. His reaction varied as well. I mean, I was very amused. A few weeks ago, I had lunch with an old friend who knew David and who had met him on the Heath, on Hampstead Heath, near where he lived in London, a year or two after my book was published. And this friend greeted David and said, he sort of alluded to the trouble with the biography. And David looked as if this was ancient history. He said, oh, the biography, oh, that was a long time ago. I glanced at it, he said. You know, as if it was just something that passed and that was it. No mention of the 22-page email with 200 and something numbered points, which he sent me at one stage, and many, many other impassioned comments, which some of which I've printed in this new book. As I said, I've told the story of that kind of struggle, and indeed even reproduced facsimiles of some of the letters, which I think themselves are quite remarkable.
You did a lecture on Le Carre and anti-Americanism, which is on YouTube. If folks can watch, I'll put a link in the notes. But it certainly also seemed like there was the political element, but it also seemed like there was a lot of long-term snobbery involved with just towards America. You know, I read this interview that came out around the time the Looking Glass War, and he kind of sniffs condescendingly about his visit to America. And there's this quote, which is just kind of crazy. I got to read this because it's kind of wild to read now. He was invited to come up and look at etchings. Gracious hostess asks whether there was anything they could do for him. Some who considered the attack the best defense made bold moves across the dinner table. Cornwell gained the impression that this was an invitation into, quote, a sort of gymnasium where they practiced their own kind of sport. It seemed almost an un-American thing to turn them down, is the quote that he has in there. Which I think was, he was being un-American and turning them down, but reading that now, you get a different read on that quote, which is kind of wild.
Yes, yes. I think also you've got to think of the context of the mid-60s, which is the sort of, I think younger people, even people my age, look back at the 60s as peace and love and Woodstock, but that's the end of the 60s. Really, the 60s is about my parents' generation of, you know, Playboy magazine and miniskirts and the pill. The pill is very important. And people, quite a lot, I think, of adultery, of infidelity, wife swapping, however you tend to, you know, whatever is the right term. That's the term they used, isn't it? Wife swapping, as if the women didn't have any agency in it at all. So, I mean, that was there in America. It was equally there, I hasten to add, in London and in some other cities in Britain. Just going back to anti-Americanism in Le Carré, I think one of the things you have to remember is his generation. I mean, I think one of the things that makes one of the abiding qualities of Le Carré, which maybe resonates more over here than it does in America, is that he is the chronicler of what somebody wittily described as Britain's post-imperial sleepwalk. He grows up with the idea that Britain still has an empire, Britain still counts, is important in the world, and indeed has had this heroic, made this heroic stand against Hitler when everyone else is either neutral or defeated. And that's a source of pride. And then the subsequent rapid decline in British importance and influence is very painful for people of his generation. And I think he's tarnished by that. For someone of my generation, I was born in 1954, it's completely different. I mean, the empire had gone by the time, and you know, we were used to the idea of Britain being a second-rate nation, and that these of superpowers, of, as they then were, the United States and the Soviet Union, completely reconciled to that. With him, it's still there, and there's a certain kind of resentment of American dominance in intelligence matters, as in everything else, that lingers and comes out in time. There's also the feelings that as he became more vocally radical, America interfering in various other parts of the world, as Britain had done in the past, just as much, and perhaps sided with the underdogs.
Nicholas Shakespeare has his biography of Ian Fleming coming out. And there's this interesting article where he's talking about Le Carré and Bond, and how Le Carré was kind of obsessive over Bond, right? You know, this hatred of Bond. And I thought it was interesting that Fleming actually spoke quite highly of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. There's this interview that he did where he's talking about it, you know, calls it a very, very fine novel and all of that. But with Le Carré and Bond, I'm curious what your thoughts are there, because I'm stealing this idea from Alex Schwartz of The New Yorker, which I just listened to this podcast she did, and she made the observation that Le Carré was living out his personal life a bit like Bond, right? These extravagant, you know, gifts and women and all of that, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
That is interesting. I hadn't quite made that connection. I mean, you know, Le Carré is much better than Fleming. I mean, there's no comparison. I've been in the past in taking part in debates, who is the more important spy writer, John Le Carré or Ian Fleming? Le Carré, Ian Fleming is really unreadable now. He depicts a world that was never realistic and is now offensive. But the Bond character has been preserved in various incarnations in the films and will keep on adapting, and is really a catch-all. So you can't really compare the two. But so Fleming should. I mean, everyone admired The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. Graham Greene described it as the best spy novel I've ever read. Graham Greene didn't know who Le Carré was. He just was sent a proof and gave that comment.
It's ironic, though. Do you think part of his hatred of Bond might have been due to seeing his own behavior reflected in that character? Or was it purely the writing, or was it his actions? Just curious.
I mean, Nicholas makes a lot of this in his book. I wouldn't go along completely with him about that. I mean, I think there's a lot to despise in the James Bond books. You know, they're sexist, they're racist, they are absurdly chauvinist. I mean, I think they, as I say, are basically unreadable nowadays, except as a period piece, you know, like you might read some other pulp authors who might come up with a objectionable attitude. So, and Bond's sexism is so ludicrous that it is almost inoffensive. One of the things that always amused me about the Bond books was the consumerism and the sort of sense that, and this is there in the early films too, the sense that taking a flight on an aeroplane or checking into a hotel was somehow glamorous. You notice how in all the early Bond films, he's like, well, then still today, he kind of checks into a hotel, and admittedly, it's often quite nice hotels, but anyone who's checked into a hotel knows that that is not a glamorous thing to do. It's pretty boring. It's a sort of vision of a, it's what I call a faux sophistication. Whereas Le Carré's book, A Spy Who Came In From the Cold in particular, was compared with Bond, I mean, almost universally in the reviews, both in Britain and in the US, and there was this idea that the Bond books were passé, were rubbish, were pulp, whereas this was the real thing, this was truthful. It was truthful not only about the reality of espionage, but also the reality of the Cold War and the reality of the cynicism at the heart of the Cold War and the moral compromises.
Well, I'm going to loop back to the affairs just for a second, because not only those are discussed in your latest book, but also you have this relationship with his godson, right?
Oh, Tim Geary, yes.
Yes, and it just showed that how he acted in affairs was very similar with how he acted in relationships with other people, right? I mean, there'd be this, like, very closeness and then pushing away.
Yes, and with Derek Johns, who incidentally was the person I mentioned earlier who met him on the Heath.
Yeah.
When Derek, just very briefly for those who haven't read the book, when Derek was a very young man, David kind of took him up as a kind of protege, and for a while he seemed like a kind of crown prince and was invited every week to go and dine with David's family, and they go for walks together, and then Derek made a gesture of independence, and David literally turned his back on him and didn't speak to him again for years. It was like a jilted lover. I mean, he was very possessive and demanding in a quite curious way. He sort of wanted absolute fealty.
So I'm curious about your role as a biographer. I love doing research and looking up stuff and doing all of that. But like, what's your favorite part of the process? I want to hear that part of being a biographer for you.
Well, I like lots of bits of it. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. But I mean, I suppose the bit that's most satisfying for me is that there always seems to be a sort of click moment with all the books I've done. I mean, in the case of the biography of John le Carré, David Cornwall, I had access to my subjects. I've written other books about people that I had never met, or people that I'd known but were then dead. But this moment is the same, really, in all those cases, which is a moment when I suddenly feel I know this person. And I think, in a way, it's a kind of self-deception, or I think probably novelists have the same experience when they come to believe in the characters they've created. They somehow get up and walk off the page, you might say. And you have to have that kind of, I don't know what it is, that trick in order for the characters to live. Well, there is a moment always when I'm writing a biography where I feel I know this person. I've got some kind of handle on them. I liken it, actually. The metaphor I sometimes use when talking about biography is of going out from the sunshine into a darkened room. And at first, you can't see anything at all. And then, as your eyes adjust, you begin to sort of make out vague details. And eventually, your eyes adapt, and you can see pretty clearly around the room in the dark. I suppose it's like that process, but accelerated. It seems to happen almost, there seems to be a magical click moment.
I'm reading this book on the history of magic, and they had this comment that I think has become more true over time, but I wonder if you would agree. It's like, if you really want to hide something or have it forgotten, put it in a book, right? Write it down, and then, you know. So did you find that true in your research when you've been, you know, researching some of your biographies?
Well, certainly with David, I knew, like I think most people who are familiar with his work know, that A Perfect Spy is an autobiographical novel, and certainly the first half of A Perfect Spy almost directly mirrors his own childhood and upbringing. But what I didn't realize is that all his books are autobiographical. So there are clues to him and how he feels and how and what's happened in his life right from the start. I mean, his very first book, which published under the title Call for the Dead, concerns the sort of initiating incident is that George Smiley has been doing what they call positive vetting, that is establishing security clearance or otherwise for someone who's about to be indoctrinated into secrets that other people can't share. And this has apparently gone wrong. The person has apparently killed themselves. And Smiley is very puzzled because it had been given a favorable security clearance for this character and had thought that it had all gone very well. Well, that's exactly what David Cornwell himself was doing at the time. He, working for MI5, he was reckoned to be extremely good at positive vetting. Partly, I think, because he has that empathy and that ability to, perhaps a slightly chameleon-like, to imagine what it was like to be somebody else and to get them to speak to him openly and truthfully. So there it is, right at the beginning of his very first book. And it goes on through and through and through. Lots and lots of... I can't think of a single one of his books that doesn't have an autobiographical element in it.
You've edited a couple books of letters. I'm assuming you've read A Private Spy. I know you...
Three.
Oh, three. Excuse me.
That's all right. Two volumes of Patrick Leigh Fermor, and I co-edited with Richard Dunbar Hines a volume with Trevor Roper's letters, Trevor Roper's letters.
Got it. Okay. I'm assuming you've read A Private Spy, or at least you've read a ton of his letters, right?
I have.
So, and it was great to get to read that because it felt like you were learning something a little different about Le Carre that we hadn't before. But how many grains of salt would you add to each letter as you would be evaluating their reality? Do you think we got more of a truthful person from those letters, or was there still a bit of that kind of lying edge to him?
I think it changes over time. And I think by and large, as he becomes a public man, his letters become less and less, maybe not less truthful, but less and less revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's a young man, not a public figure, he has no reason for guile or concealment. Later on, he's watching what he writes carefully, and I find his later letters less interesting. Incidentally, I think Tim Cornwell, the youngest son of his first marriage, who very tragically died before that book was published, did an excellent job with that book. I think, the only thing I would say is probably it's a bit too long. It's shown good judgment and selection and annotation of the letters. And you might say, I would say that, wouldn't I? Because Tim says some very nice things about me in his introduction. No, I like that book and admire what he did with it.
You stated you enjoyed his earlier work a lot more than his later work. And you even said, I think Silverview shouldn't have been published at one point. I think I heard you say that in an interview. But you've had a chance to read his early drafts as he worked on his novels. Was there something you saw that changed in his writing as he got older that might have led to that change in the style and quality of the work?
Can I answer that question possibly in two ways? What I saw was his early versions of his books through various, and unfortunately, this process ends with the advent of word processing and computers. So, for example, with The Night Manager, I could see I think 19 different versions of Chapter 1. And how it's a completely different book when he first starts writing it. Completely different. Different characters, different plot, everything's different. I, in fact, go into that in some detail in the biography, the 2015 biography. So I was able to see that. In terms of how he changes over time, I just feel, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but, you know, he's the definitive novelist of the Cold War, by none. And I think there's an argument that The Honorable Schoolboy, although not notionally about the Vietnam War, is one of the major books about the Vietnam War, even though it's written by a Brit and from the side, you know, we didn't take part in the Vietnam War. But you know, his depiction of the dominoes collapsing from the inside is, I think, extraordinarily vivid and powerful. But I think that the cliche is that he lost his subject when the Cold War ended, and I think to some extent that's true. And I certainly think that the later Le Carre is not nearly as subtle or ambiguous as the early Le Carre. I mean, one of the things that happens is he becomes more and more dogmatic and preachy. And so there are good guys and bad guys, and there's no ambiguity between them. The early Le Carre is not like that at all. Everyone is morally compromised. And there are good guys and bad guys on both sides. But the later books, even in the style, the prose style, he has people coming out with great long kind of manifestos almost, in a way that no one would ever speak in real life. So I don't admire those later books nearly as much. I mean, there are a few exceptions. I think A Most Wanted Man is not a bad book, but I think some of the later books are pretty poor. I didn't much care for A Delicate Truth or A Legacy of Spies. I found embarrassingly bad. It's also, it's one of the problems with a very successful writer is that people stop telling them the truth. People say, if an editor tries to edit his work, he simply gets in touch with the head of the firm and says, I want a new editor. You know, I mean, put it this way, if anyone tries to tell him the truth, he doesn't listen. Perhaps I may have to leave this advice myself in my much more lowly level. Perhaps we should all be forced to retire at a certain point. But of course, there are great commercial pressures to go on writing. One of the things that surprised me looking at his career in as a whole is how some of the early books, which I regarded as masterpieces, received quite mixed and indifferent reviews, both in the UK and the US and elsewhere. Whereas some of the later books, which I think are not nearly as good, received almost universal praise. And I think, is everyone blind? Yeah. You know, why are people, why do people not notice that this isn't really very good? I don't know. That's just my opinion. Other people have different opinions.
So you've written a lot about con men. Like your book, The Professor and the Parson, is really so much fun to read.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that.
It's about Hugh Trevor Roper kind of obsessively following this guy who is just a completely bonkers character. But how much did writing about Ronnie Cornwell inform that book?
Little bit. Actually, I had a sort of similar story in my own family. I'm ashamed to say that my grandfather was a con man. He wasn't quite as much of a monster as Ronnie Cornwell, but, you know, he was a bad person who certainly didn't pay his bills. So there's a little bit of that went into it. But really, just that person, that he was a clergyman, a would-be clergyman. The subtitle of The Professor and the Parson is a story of desire, deceit, and defrocking. Which you can see in more ways than one, because he had at least 8 wives, this chap. I think at one stage, 4 of them simultaneously. And I keep on finding more details about him, by the way. Some have just come emerge in the last few weeks.
Oh, wow.
So it's a never-ending story, really. But I think to tie it back into David, I mean, I sent a copy of that book to David, having not been in touch with him, really, since my book was published. So this is, I don't know, 3 years later. And he sent me a very nice letter back, which I quote from in this new book, saying, I thought about giving you a quote for your book, but I thought that would be a bit creepy. But he said, yes, it did remind me of Ronnie, and I enjoyed it very much. So it was nice that our last communication was on a friendly, respectful level.
Yeah. No, well, it's a great book, and I recommend folks pick it up because it was really, really fun. Would you ever consent to somebody writing a biography of you? Would you be okay with the tables being turned, or do you already have your Boswell is already turned up?
Certainly not. No, I'd absolutely run a mile. Fortunately, it's not likely to happen. I mean, you know, what's there to be said? I don't know. I have thought about autobiographical writing. I think I'm quite interested in my own family. I did have slightly strange, eccentric origins. And like David himself, I'm not quite what I maybe seem to be, which I only discovered in midlife. In a sense, all of us are in the process of writing our own autobiographies, even if they don't get published all the time, because we're all trying to make sense of our lives.
I'm assuming this is your last book on Le Carré, so, and maybe I'm wrong.
I hope so, in a way. I mean, in fact, somebody suggested the other day a possible third book, but I really ought to let it go, I think. And I think my family say, you know, enough. It's a bit strange to return to a subject after 8 years as well, and after several books in between. What I hope people don't feel is that there's any sense of revenge or point scoring or whatever. I hope this interview makes clear, if anything, that I just don't feel those things. I feel, when I think about David, I think of him with a smile on my face, really. I think of him as a naughty man in some ways, a man who wasn't always truthful, but someone who was always fun to meet.
I was hoping you could tell us, are you working on something next? What is your next project?
Oh, yes. Yes. I wrote two biographies of British historians who I think probably very, very few of your readers will ever have heard of, A.J.P. Taylor and Hugh Trevor Open, that you mentioned before. And I'm writing yet now a third biography of an historian, well, Asa Briggs, who I'm certain no one will have heard of. I hope that I will manage to persuade some American readers that it is an interesting subject. There are reasons for thinking that he is interesting, but I won't attempt to persuade you now. You'll have to wait till the book is written.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me. This is really just a pleasure. And I encourage folks to pick up The Secret Life of John le Carré and read it, because I think it really gets at something about the man that is not necessary to read his books, but helpful to know. Yeah, especially if you read the biography that you previously wrote, you have to read this one. It's essential.
Well, I'm glad you think. I mean, that's what I think too. And I genuinely think, and thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Well, that's going to wrap things up for this episode. Feel free to give us a review on Apple Podcasts and check the show notes for links to everything that we mentioned in the show. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.